day job. It is in full-time work and part-time money, and has been pretty much since I started.
So this is kind of labor of love for you?
No, it's what I have done as my primary source of income since 1986. I'm fortunate enough to have a wife who also has a job, who, you know, with a kind of more regular income, so that I can afford to do this. But it's been a self-supporting income-producing business since I started it.
And how's that working out these days?
These days? well, you know, it's a tough time for people who do what I do, and it has been ever since the advent of the internet. And I think anybody involved in any kind of collectibles related business would pretty much tell you the same thing.
So can you describe your average customer? I imagine you have a lot of teen business.
I can't really because I have been mail order and online now since 2000 or 2001, almost exclusively. I would say I probably have only had actual contact with maybe fewer than 5% of my customers.
Really? Do you have an actual physical presence, or it's like out of your garage, so to speak?
Well, I am a real person. Yes, I'm here. No, well, it's kind of complicated, but when we went house hunting, we bought a house that would also serve as an in-home business. So what we have, if you come here, and many people over the years have, is a gigantic baseball room that essentially
cool.
Looks like a bookstore, except that all the books are baseball.
Very cool, very cool.
So it is a physical place of business, and, you know, my family over the years learned that when Bobby went downstairs to the baseball room, that meant he was going to work, just like, you know, when Mom got in the car and drove away, and that kind of worked over the years. Yes, there is an actual physical location that I work out at.
How many books do you have in your inventory at any one time?
I never do a count. My best guess is 5,000 to 7,000.
Wow.
Now that includes a few books that are about sports other than baseball, and you know it's always a difficult thing. But you have books like annuals, like the Sporting News annuals that came out every year. So as a book dealer, I consider, you know, the Sporting News guides as one entity, but obviously, you know, if you have a run of from the 40s to the 70s, you have 30 volumes. So that's where the $5,000 to $7,000 volume count comes in. If you count all the guides as an individual entity, it's less. If you count each single one, and of course I have duplicates of a lot of them, then it gets up there. That's a pretty rough count. I think that's probably accurate.
And have you acquired your stock?
Any way possible? Nowadays it's mostly from online vendors and from people who read one of my ads in one of the various places that it is located, and, you know, have books to sell, and, you know, tell me what they are, and I make an offer on them, and I either buy them or not. These days, former customers, which is kind of depressing, actually. At one time, I had sworn that I would get out of the business before people started selling me collections. I had helped them build that, but I haven't been completely successful in that. In the old days, there were more sources. You used to have people like book scouts who would go to yard sales or even go to, you know, antique stores or thrift stores in their town and, you know, kind of mine for stuff and write me and say, oh, I just bought this, do you want it, or offer it at a fixed price. That has tended to die down because I think those people pretty much have eliminated the middleman, which is me, and, you know, sell directly to customers on eBay and other online.
So how do you go about setting the prices on your books?
I could tell you, but I'd have to kill you. It's both an art and a science. It's based on my personal past experience with the book. It's based on, you know, how well it sells, how well it doesn't sell. These days, I always check to see if there are, you know, current records of the book having sold or not sold, or how many are listed online or not listed online. And these days, I'm not like a retail bookstore that sells new books where you pay a certain percentage of the publisher's price and then you try and sell the book in your store, and if you can't sell the book, you get to return it to the publisher. The books that I buy don't have any necessarily have any fixed price, and I could pay $5 for a copy of, you know, the Ron Kaplan story today and $20 for it next week, just depending on the seller and the condition and stuff like that. But the point is I am usually pretty aware at the time that I purchase something, how much I'm paying for it, and you know, I kind of have a mental idea in my mind of what my retail price is going to be then, too. So I kind of get to set the buy prices, and that kind of drives the sell prices.
What's the most expensive item you have right now?
Oh, right now? Good question.
Yeah, I was going through the catalog, and it's quite nice. I like the way you put your own little anecdotes in there, rather than just a cold text. This is the book, this is the publisher, this is... So that's kind of, and I noticed some pretty pricey things in there. Of course, they're kind of old. I imagine they're very rare as well.
Yeah. Let me just take a quick look. Probably off the top of my head, I think I have the Newton Crane book in there. That's an 1890s book from London called Baseball, and that's priced at $500. I have a really scarce Honus Wagner paperback that's also priced at $500. I had another book from England on baseball that was at $650 that sold, so I don't really have it anymore. And I probably have some more expensive stuff that's more expensive just on basis because it's autographed. I have a Louisville Colonels yearbook from the 1940s, and the Colonels were a Red Sox farm team at that time, and the yearbook, you know, has like individual pictures of all the players and also of the executives. Well, the executives of the Red Sox at that time, Yawkey was the owner, Herb Pennock was the farm director, I think. And both of them have signed this book, and they're both Hall of Famers, and Pennock, I guess, particularly, is a very scarce autograph. So that book's up there. That's like in the $900 range.
And can you think of anything that's like very unusual? I mean, obviously the Louisville yearbook, the minor league yearbook, is a little unusual.
Very unusual that I have.
Yeah, the most fun thing you have that you can think of.
Let's see, the most fun thing I have. Off the top, I'm not going to say anything, not because I don't have any fun things, but because I have so many, I don't really know what
like
to
like children, you can't pick a favorite.
Well, it's true, and, you know, if I was up and walking around, I could kind of give you an audio tour of the shelves and tell you what's on there. But, I am attracted to the kind of weird and oddball, so as long as it's, you know, I just sold a book about, that was, it was an astrology book about the 1973 Cincinnati Reds. And it had astrological profiles for each of them for the upcoming season. So that was a pretty odd and weird.
Well, speaking personally, one of the genres of baseball books I find very interesting are the cookbooks.
Yeah. Yeah, and
Harry Carey cookbook, and they're baseball players' wives on occasion put up cookbooks that they've sold to the teams or charity.
Well, one of the coolest cookbooks, and I actually don't know if it's in the catalog or not, but I think it was 1986, Wade Boggs actually published a cookbook of chicken recipes.
Of course.
Illustrated by his father.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it was essentially self-published. It's actually, in the days before the internet, it was an extremely difficult book to find. I would say I'd only seen maybe one or two of them. Since that, it's become somewhat more findable, but it's still a pretty scarce item, and it's a really legitimate cookbook. I've actually made some of the recipes that were in there, and I think I have a Boot Pal cookbook based on his barbecue recipes from his little stand in Camden Yards. And in the 70s, most teams, they had, you know, like wives auxiliaries or women's auxiliaries, and basically the players' wives would put together cookbooks and then sell them for charity. Mm-hmm. And the money would go to whatever charitable organization they were supporting. And some of those are really cool. Some of them have the players actually contributing recipes. Some of them are signed. But I would say, you know, I've seen a cookbook from most teams, you know, sometime in that era. The Mets put out one called The Gore Mets, which a personal favorite as a big Mets fan.
Uh-huh. In your experience, is there one type of book that sells better than others, like a biography or a team history or Bill James or statisticals?
The general rule of thumb in the book, in the used book trade, in the used book trade as a whole, is the more specific the volume, the greater likelihood that it will have value. So the Ron Kaplan story would, in theory, be more valuable than, you know, great baseball bloggers of the 2000s.
Nice.
If you follow what I say. And I would say baseball probably follows that trend. So a book about the St. Louis Cardinals will tend to be of more interest and perhaps a higher price than, you know, greatest teams of the pick your era or forever. Biographies are always popular, although these days with so many being published, it popular is kind of like a relative term. The various niches of baseball collecting are also reflected in people who collect baseball books. So, you know, there's always been strong interest in books about the Negro Leagues or players and African American baseball, and similarly with the minor leagues. And most minor league teams over the years have published, or lots and lots of minor league teams have published, not only record books with statistical data, but actual team histories. And because of the self-published regional nature of those volumes, they can be hard to find. And some of them are quite well done with a lot of photographs. And they can be, you know, there's, how do I put this? The general baseball book public isn't necessarily that interested in them, but the people who have a strong interest right. in the minor leagues really, really, really are interested in them. Books about stadiums were very popular until they kind of proliferated in the 2000s, and now there's like so many you can't keep track of them. As a result, kind of interest has waned. So that's what I would say.
What about biographies of, I remember back when the Mets won the series in 86, and you started having like Dykstra wrote a biography,
yeah.
and Davey Johnson came out with a book. What about these like one-hit wonder types? How do those do?
Well, you know, here's the rule of thumb in baseball book selling is virtually any baseball book published by a major publisher since 1975 is readily available for $10 or less, and in many cases a lot less. And you know, by their nature, how do I put this? The one-hit wonders on the Kansas City Royals don't get books written about them. It's only the ones in New York and you know, sometimes L.A. So by definition, they're almost overpublished at the time, so there's never any great interest. The Dykstra book is kind of interesting because that's the one book about from that era that at least at one point was you know, that might be like a $15 book instead of a $10 book. For some reason, I'm not really sure. There's some interest in those books because as long as the players are around and active, people will buy the books to get them autographed. But in general, if the local Kansas City newspaper put out a little biography of you know, Freddie Patek after the Royals won the World Series and the distribution never got much beyond Kansas City, that book might have a lot of interest, but that just doesn't happen very often.
And what about
fiction?
There is
no Freddie Patek book. I just made that up.
And what about fiction?
Fiction is a niche within a niche within a niche within a niche. I used to have a very active and substantial group of customers who were interested in baseball fiction, but the market never grew. So what happened was, as I found this, you know, as I found the somewhat scarce books, and then the really scarce books, and then the, you know, kind of desirable books, and then the really desirable books, and then the really, really desirable books, I kept selling them, and eventually no one needed them anymore. So I essentially liquidated my fiction inventory in 2000. sold it to a former customer, and he was getting into the online book business, and he put them online. I do have a fiction list, as you've seen, that came about because 6 years after I swore I would never sell fiction again, an old customer sent me his collection of books, and about a third of it was fiction, and they were just in such nice condition that I couldn't bear to part with them. But as you've seen the list, there's a lot of books you've never heard of on that list, and they're still there, which means that their interest in them is pretty small. And more to the point, interest is so small that when one of the books does turn up online, they tend to sell for very, very low prices. And I can tell you that the fiction list you're looking at, if I had issued that list in 1990, most of the prices on there would have been twice what they are on the list. Maybe even more than that. I mean, I'm selling books for $25 now that I used to get $125 for. That's true. That's true all across the board, but it's especially true in fiction.
I'm looking at the cover of the nonfiction catalog. I don't see. Do you have a website?
No, I don't have a website yet. The catalog is available online through the Sabre Classifieds, through the Sabre.org website. You click on Classifieds and then click on Books. You'll see a little ad, and it'll send you a link to the PDF of the catalog. I do have about 1,500 to 2,000 titles listed among the various used bookselling websites that are online, mainly ABE Books, Elibris.com, and also on Amazon. That's not exclusively baseball, but probably about, the online listings are probably about 60% baseball.
Mm-hmm. Now, this might be hard for you. I'm sure you're very well read. Do you have a favorite book?
No.
No?
I'm not going to say my favorite book. The first thing is, and this might seem kind of odd, but I probably haven't read a baseball book published in the last 20 years.
No.
I've skimmed them all. I've looked at them all. I've read reviews of them all, or a lot of them. I've talked to people about them, but actually sitting down. So it's kind of like my favorite list stops. My favorite list doesn't include anything recent just because I haven't gotten around to reading it yet. And you know, no, I'm not going to pick one because they're just, you know, the book that comes to mind as a favorite, and we're talking favorite, which has actually nothing to do with quality, although I also think this is a great book too, is a book by Joel Oppenheimer called The Wrong Season.
I remember that, sure.
And what he did was he decided to follow the New York Mets in 1974 after they had been to the World Series after their miracle NLCS championship or their miracle National League East division. And the 1974 was a horrible
right.
And so what this becomes is a fan's chronicle of a season that started with promise and just ended in misery. And he's a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant writer, and he's writing about a team and players that I really knew and really, really cared about. And the book was published in 1974. It was the first time I've seen in print someone writing about a phenomenon which, you know, since then I've heard about, but which I knew to be true, which was, you know, the belief that you sitting at home can, you know, raise your left hand at the right time and make your favorite player hit a home run. And he talks about, you know, all the things he did to try and get, you know, Tom Seaver to throw a strike or you know, John Matlack to get this last out or you know, Bud Harrelson to get the bunt down or whatever it was. And talks about, you know, how he sits at home and you know, moves to the left, moves to the right, you know, drinks his beer with his left hand, right hand, and you know, until then, I guess I won't say that I had thought that, you know, I was the only person who did that, but it was something to, you know, see that in print, and especially from a writer who, you know, I kind of respect a lot, so I love that book.
Now, you say you haven't read anything in the last 20 years that has come out in the last 20 years. Is that because there's just so much out there, or are you just... Once you have all this around, you just don't want to anymore.
It's both. It's a combination of volume and time, and yeah, I to a certain extent, I spend so much time with these in my professional life that you know, when I'm away from work, I kind of like to read about other stuff too. And you know, you talk about the little blurbs, and I would say over the years, that's probably been the thing that the most people have said complimentarily about me, is that, you know, they really like the blurbs. And a lot of people have said, you know, I bought this book because of what you wrote in there. And, you know, I kind of made a conscious decision when I first started doing this that I would try to do what I did, was write a little something in there, and a little more than, you know, this is a book about ballparks, or, you know, this is a hard-to-find book, or something like that. Try and give the reader, my reader, you know, a sense of what the book was about. And, you know, the way you do that is you kind of have to skim every single book. Now, you know, I vowed that I wouldn't rely on dust jacket blurbs. I do rely on prefaces and forewords a lot, because, you know, you often get, the author will also say, you know, the reason I wrote this book is because, and you know, what better way to introduce a reader to a book than to tell you why the writer wrote it. But so my point is while I have not read all that many books from cover to cover, recently published books from cover to cover, I've spent a lot of time with them, even if I haven't read them. You know, looking for quotes, or trying to get a sense of my own of what the book is about, so I can summarize it for my customers.
Mm-hmm. All right, very good. Well, Bobby, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today,
okay.
And good luck in the coming season.
Okay, thank you.
Okay,
let's go Mets. Bye.